Hello and welcome to CICK News. CICK News is your local and regional news coverage provided by me, Pamela Hassan, and Dan Messick for Smithers Community Radio. This news program is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada, and our aim is to provide local coverage on stories that affect the lives of Northerners like you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Golden Gate Indian Casting Club.
Spey casting originated on the Spey River in Scotland because of limited space behind you of trees and bushes and whatnot, and having to make a long cast with a fly rod. So they came up with a way of anchoring the line in the water and then being able to make a long cast.
It's one of the neatest parts about being here. Everybody wants the best for each other, you know, even amongst the competitors in the same field. And because it's a lot of the same people who come back every year, it is like a family. It is a really good community.
Cast number 7, left single, score.
That's local Kara Knight speaking to KQED, a San Francisco public radio station reporter, about the Spey-O-Rama, a fly casting competition that takes place at the Golden Gate Angling and Casting Club in San Francisco. It began in 1933 at the Angler's Lodge in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park and has hosted national casting tournaments for over a decade and currently hosts the annual World Championships in Spey Casting, or Spey-O-Rama, each April. Kara attended Spey-O-Rama again this year and for the first time won the women's title, both in forecast total and longest cast, with casts of 520 and 135 feet respectively. Next, she's off to the World's Championship in Aarhus, Sweden, and I caught up with her in Paris, France, during a petite vacance on her way to represent Canada at the World Fly Casting Competition.
Hi, I'm Kara Knight.
First off, Kara, thank you so much for making the time to squeeze me in to chat, because it's been quite a whirlwind, it sounds like. So I have a basic question to start off with, but could you tell me what is fly casting?
Yeah, fly casting is basically the method of fly fishing, and it can be done with either a smaller single-hand rod or a bigger two-handed rod, which is what a lot of people use in Smithers for steelhead fishing, is a big two-handed spey rod. But the actual casting technique is what you would call fly casting.
Okay, so it's the art of casting out the line. Is it supposed to look beautiful and fluid as well? It's entrancing to watch someone do it, even though I don't really know what exactly they're doing.
Yeah, it is. And to actually do it is quite relaxing, and lots of people find it meditative as well. I think it's just the nature of it, the art of it, if you want to call it an art. It's definitely much more of a finesse thing and a technique thing than a power thing. Like the more effort you put into it, the harder it gets. If you can relax and make it more fluid, it works better. And yeah, it looks really nice.
How did you start and what drew you to it?
So I actually started years ago, I guess almost 20 years ago now. I worked at my first fishing lodge on the West Coast, and it was a saltwater fishing lodge, but there was a number of guides there who were from the lower mainland, and they were all into steelhead fishing, and several of them had brought spey rods with them, and they would cast off the dock in the evening when everybody was done work. So that was my first kind of introduction to spey casting. Mm-hmm. And there was also people going fly fishing up in the mountains for salmon and stuff like that as well with single hand rods. So that was my first introduction to it. At that point, I hadn't really done it before, but I befriended some of those guides and got to go fishing in the lower mainland. And the first time I went out, I got a bite from the steelhead, and I was just, pardon the pun, but I was absolutely hooked. Like, it was so exciting and fun to be out in the wilderness and out in these beautiful places with amazing friends and doing something that was, yeah, that was really incredible. So
I will pardon the pun, by the way, because I'm a bit of a fan of puns myself.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so you just flew from Smithers to San Francisco to Paris, France, where I'm speaking to you now, on your way to Sweden for the Fly Casting World Championships. So I guess just before we speak about the worlds, can you tell me about San Francisco's Spey-O-Rama and how you did and how that competition went?
Yeah, so San Francisco hosts a spey casting specific competition every year called Spey-O-Rama, and it's held at the Golden Gate Angling and Casting Club, which is in Golden Gate Park. It's a really cool organization, and I've been going to that competition since roughly 2012, I think. And I've sat comfortably in the second spot for a number of years, and then I managed to win it this year. So it was a pretty exciting year to go down there and have that happen.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's funny because your Facebook post, you really don't boast that you came in first place at all, by the way. You buried the lead there.
I don't know. It's such a fun event. It's usually all the same people. Like for me, I was just happy to go back down there. It's been a number of years since I was able to go. But it's really a family of people, just all of us who nerd out on how far we can throw a piece of yarn with this fly rod. And to see those people again and be in that environment was the best part of it. But yeah, I was absolutely over the moon to have won it this year.
So next you're headed to Aarhus, Sweden for the World's Championship. How are you feeling about that? What are you most excited about? Tell me what the state of mind you're in now today on this kind of part where you're waiting and you're about to step over the precipice into Worlds.
Yeah, I'm excited and I'm nervous, which I think is pretty normal. Of course, I'm excited for the traveling and to see new places. A number of the people that come to San Francisco are going to be there, so I'll get to see lots of familiar faces. But it's also a totally different venue. The San Francisco event is held in these man-made ponds that are really sheltered and really controlled environment. The event in Oahu, in a bay in the open ocean, so we could be seeing wind, we could be seeing waves. Like, that's probably the part that I'm most nervous about, is that I really don't know what I'm going into. But It's my first time attending the Worlds, and honestly, I think it's going to be a good experience regardless of how I place, and I'm just excited to go and see it and experience it.
Yeah. Do you think that your experience up here in the North, fly casting up here in the North, would assist you rather than maybe people who do practice more in man-made ponds?
Maybe. I practiced in Ross Lake all summer, and I tell you, we had a windy summer. Maybe that'll stand me in good stead for this event. We'll find out. But yeah, I've never done this type of casting in the open ocean. It's a little bit different than it is in a more controlled environment. So yeah, we'll see.
I want you to walk me through what happens at a World's Fly Casting Competition. What are you scored on, and what do the events look like?
So they do the full spectrum of fly casting events at this one. So there'll be both single-hand events and two-handed events. And I'm only doing the two-handed events this year. The single-hand ones are more like what you would see really avid trout anglers doing. So they have an accuracy event where they've got rings laid out in the water and they have to hit certain targets at certain distances and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then they have a distance event for both the single-hand and the double-handed events. And there's a lane that you have to stay within. It's about 5 meters wide and it's got certain angles, but you have to keep your fly within that line for it to count. And then you're just casting it as far as you can, and you have a certain amount of time to make as many casts as you can. And I think with the spay casting, the two-handed casting, you have to do right and left-handed casts. And so they take your best casts on each of those sides and they add that up, and that's your score.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at the ICSF rule book, and it states that each nation can participate with a maximum of 8 casters in each event and 4 casters in each event in the veteran classes. So Do you know your fellow Canadian casters? Are you all competing for Canada, or are you competing individually?
I'm the only Canadian who's going this year. So from what I've heard back quite a while ago, there used to be a casting association in Canada. But the people who had brought that into being, I think, have let it lapse or are no longer in it anymore. And although there's several Canadians who go to San Francisco to compete in that event, there's no association, there's no federation anymore. And nobody else was able to come with me this year. So It's just me this time. And hopefully in the future, I want to try to revive that organization in some way, shape, or form, and also try to bring more people into the sport. It's such a fun event, and especially for women. Like, it's a very, fishing is a really male-dominated industry, and we're always trying to get more ladies involved in it. Women tend to be really good at it because they don't try to muscle it.
Right.
And it's just a really fun culture and group of people and friends that you make. Yeah, hopefully in the future, we'll see more Canadians in it.
Yeah, wow. That's really surprising to me for Canada having as many lakes and just angling and fishing and fly fishing being such a passion for so many people. So that's really, that's quite surprising.
Yeah, no, it's surprising to me too, that there's not more Canadians who do it. So I don't know. We'll see if we can get some momentum and get some people interested in it.
Yeah. So, Kara, I have a question that's, it's less about specifically your experience, but I did notice a note on the Flycasting World Championships on the website when it says that Russian and Belarusian flycasters are banned this year from the competition. Do you have any thoughts? Do you have any thoughts or feelings on that?
I don't know a lot about it, honestly. This has all come up pretty quickly for me, and I'm not incredibly familiar with the ICFF. I guess for me, I noticed that as well, and I guess I wasn't surprised to see it. There's a pretty large contingent of Russian casters that usually comes to San Francisco that we haven't seen for a couple of years now. Oh. So like I said, not surprised to see it. A bit disappointed because I think maybe you're painting the whole nation with one brush by doing that.
I do, yeah.
But I honestly don't know enough about it to be able to speak very in depth on it.
Okay, yeah. The Flycasting website, they did have their UN pledges as well. So they do seem to be quite a flycasting first, but also political and geopolitically minded organization as well. Do you know much about the organization?
I don't know. Like I said, it's pretty new to me. Like I went to the San Francisco event at the end of April, and it was only a few weeks after that in May when I started considering actually going to this event. I haven't had a lot of time to learn about it or look into it.
Yeah. So you came in first in San Francisco. So I got to assume that when I see a subtly, maybe the most subtly bragging post about you being in our house, it's going to probably got first place as well. But good luck on everything. And it really, you can really hear the passion in your voice behind fly casting. So I think this is just going to be a really awesome experience for you.
Thank you. Yeah, of course, I hope I do well. But I'm really, the fun thing about going the first time to something is that you can really set the bar low for yourself. And I think my goal is to just have a good time. And if I happen to do really well, then I'll be really excited about that too.
Yeah, great. I do look forward to connecting with you when you are back in the Bulkley Valley here and have a chat about, yeah, just how it felt and how it all went.
Absolutely. That sounds amazing.
Great. Thank you so much, Kara, for taking the time to speak with me while you're in a lovely cafe in Paris. I don't know if I would be as kind as you were about being like, oh, sure, yeah, I'll get on your little news radio station.
No, this is perfect. Thank you so much. It was really exciting to hear from you. And I'm happy to chat anytime.
Oh, great. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Many people live in an area at risk of a wildfire here in BC. So it's important to take the time to get prepared if you find yourself in the position of needing to evacuate your home and to understand what to do before, during, and after a wildfire. But living in uncertainty and not knowing how to cope with the stress for yourself and your loved one takes a toll on your mental and physical health. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Raina Fomerton in Prince George about the stresses and trauma that can come with needing to evacuate your home due to a natural disaster, and how to manage your and your family's anxieties. It may be helpful to keep a pen and paper close. If you are listening at the end of the conversation, Dr. Raina Fomerton shares phone numbers for crisis lines, as well as helpful websites to prepare you for the physical and mental strain of needing to evacuate your home due to a natural disaster.
My name is Dr. Raina Fomerton. I'm a public health preventive medicine physician, and I'm one of the medical health officers at Northern Health.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, Dr. Fomerton. So today we're speaking about coping through disaster stress. And in the province right now, a big stress for people is wildfires. It's the uncertainty and the decision to leave your home. It's got to be one of the biggest stresses that a family can experience. Can you tell me what some of the stresses of being evacuated due to an emergency would be?
Yeah, absolutely. Having to flee your home and leave all of your possessions behind and relocate can definitely cause a lot of anxiety and fear. And it's like very normal for those who have had to evacuate or who may have to evacuate to have those feelings. It's like you said, a lot of uncertainty. It's a very abnormal situation. And it's very difficult to predict when a big wildfire is going to occur. Just around that concept of stress and anxiety around this whole sort of issue in the context of climate change and climate change events and wildfires specifically are hitting us hard again this year would be kind of four categories. One would be to prepare. Two would be to take care of the basics. Three would be ask for help. And fourth would be help others. And I can go into each of those in a little more detail if that would be helpful.
Yeah, please do.
Well, the first one is preparing both yourself and your family, having that clear emergency plan and kit ready for your family. If you have pets and livestock as well, that can really ease your mind and allow you to focus on other things. So if for resources to help you understand the hazards in your area, and then also resources to help you build your personal or family emergency plan, you can visit Prepared BC. And then for the wildfire smoke and steps you can take around protecting your health, you can visit the BC CDC, the BC Center for Disease Control. There's tons of just superb resources on steps you can take. So then the second category in terms of trying to stay mentally healthier this summer would be to take care of the basics. And I know it sounds obvious, like eating and getting enough sleep, being kind to yourself, giving and accepting support, having a daily routine where you integrate things that are helpful and work for you, for your mental and physical health. And some people don't think about this, but actually the news coverage around disaster events and occurring all over BC, Canada, and in the world, taking a break from some of that and from thinking and talking about disasters all the time can also give yourself that mental space. And then thirdly, it would be ask for help. So whether it's family, friends, a doctor, a professional counselor, that really can be helpful to just talk. Keeping things bottled up inside is never a good thing for stress and anxiety. There's also crisis lines that are available 24/7. If you've been experiencing symptoms for more than a couple of weeks, you should probably consult your family physician or call the virtual Northern Health Hotline or one of the crisis lines, because one of the crisis lines would be great for in the moment stress. But if you're having long-term chronic stress, speaking to a physician would be advisable. And then in Northern Health, we also have mental health community programs, which you can look up online. And for those who may not be aware of what the symptoms can include for stress and anxiety, some of them can include sleeping and eating disturbances, feeling sad, depressed, or hopeless, being anxious or fearful, and having recurring pervasive thoughts or even nightmares about the event, and avoiding activities or places that remind them of the event. And then last but not least is helping others. That can both be positive mental health benefits for yourself to be helping others, as well as for those other people that you're helping. It's potentially more challenging for people living with mental health issues or anyone that have few kind of social support. So really reaching out to connect can be a huge help. If you've experienced previous wildfire evacuations or health effects due to the smoke in the air, you may need help from the adults that provide care for them. And so there's a really good list of mental health tips for parents on the Canadian Mental Health Association website.
Dr. Ferberton, you actually touched on what I did want to speak on next, with more specifically for caregivers. If you wouldn't mind extrapolating on what some of the tactics for parents with young children being, as you mentioned, first off, exposed to the smoke, but then also asking questions to their parents that their parents might not know how to answer. Why did this happen? Who's going to help us? Are we safe? Those kind of questions. Are there maybe some examples or tips that you would give parents in order to help explain a very difficult situation to children?
So for the littles, you want to be quite concrete. So for example, if there's a power outage, you tell the child, like, the wind broke a tree branch and it fell on the electrical line, and that's why the lights don't work. So just so similar for whatever the emergency or the situation is, just trying to be simple and very like concrete. That's how they best understand. And the younger children might regress a little bit in terms of behavior, and just letting them know that's okay. So they might wet their bed, they might start sucking their thumb, doing things that they did like that stopped doing a couple years ago, and being very clingy and cry, and just letting them know that's okay. And for us as parents to also just anticipate that is actually expected and normal, and reassuring them that you will keep them safe. Yeah, for kids more in that 6 to 11 age range, they're obviously like more capable of articulating their own understandings and their beliefs and whatnot. So it's helpful to ask them what they understand about the situation and what they feel about it. So oftentimes children will tell you things and their fears are actually based on like misinformation, which you then as a parent or caregiver have the opportunity to correct, and then letting them ask questions and just knowing it's okay to, when kids ask questions, that you can say you don't know it as an answer to some of those questions. Kids are very attached to their routine as much as possible, try to keep their routines, keep their play dates, keep their bedtime routine, all of those things as much as possible. That's very comforting for children, giving them, like, this is true for all things in life when raising children, but when possible, giving them that sense that they do get chances to make decisions and feel in control. But during times of stress, it's even more important. Little things like giving the choices of what to wear. Do you want to wear this hat or that hat? And maybe what to eat. Do you want carrots or peppers or things like that, just giving them a sense of control. And similar to what I talked about for the little, the very little children, just understanding that there's going to be some behavioral instability, potentially nightmares, irritability, anger outbursts and withdrawal, perhaps, like all the spectrum of things, crying and getting angry, and just letting them know that, and so expecting that again as a parent, that's normal, and then letting them know it's normal. And then finally, when you're talking about the older children, adolescent children, ages 12 to 17, ask how you can support them and acknowledge their feelings. They may be having flashbacks or depression or nightmares, and just asking how you can support them. Sometimes being involved as well in helping the community is actually very therapeutic. If there's any sort of rebuilding activity or volunteer community sort of things where they can feel useful rather than feeling helpless, at that age, children can be very useful and helpful. And so getting them involved in what they can be useful for in terms of rebuilding efforts or community spirit raising efforts or things like that, any kind of volunteering that might be age appropriate for them, getting them involved so they don't feel like they're having things are just done to them versus them actually being engaged. Like I've said about, you know, for even for adults to be kind to themselves during these events, the same could go for children and adolescents. So it's a slow process in terms when you experience a disaster or an evacuation. And so it's just letting them know they should be patient with themselves and kind to themselves as well as others. And then those who may have been previously traumatized through previous traumatic events, previous disasters, previous like abuse or trauma, or if they have a mental health problem, being prepared to offer potentially some extra professional support for those adolescents is just something to keep in mind if you see that they're really not coping well.
Would you mind sharing some of the maybe phone numbers, and then I guess I'll just encourage listeners to actually put them into your phone so that you don't need to rely on the internet to try to find these. But if you wouldn't mind sharing some of those phone numbers.
Yeah, no worries. So the first would be the Northern BC Crisis Line. So that's 1-888-562-1214. The Canadian Mental Health Association also has a crisis line at 1-977-427-4884. There's also Cuyus, it's an Indigenous specific crisis line. And so for culturally relevant support, that is also an option for our Indigenous populations. And that number is 1-800-558-8717. There's also a provincial crisis line, which is 1-800-SUICIDE. And the number for that is, again, 1-800-784-2433. And then in terms of like where to go online for some reliable and evidence-based resources to cope with wildfire and natural disaster stress, you can visit the Government of BC Natural Disaster and Health. So if you just Google that, you'll find that on the provincial government website, or you can go to bcdisasterstress.ca. If you don't have a pen on you right now, you can go to the Government Natural Disaster and Health or the BC Disaster Stress .ca websites when you have a moment and find out a whole bunch more useful information. So hopefully that is helpful for your listenership.
Dr. Farberton, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and to share this very important information with our listeners.
You're so welcome. Yeah, it's such an important topic to cover. So thank you for helping spread the word and recommendations around this important issue that's really affecting so many people right now.
Lastly, today on CICK News, I caught up with the Northwest Fire Center's information officer for an update on our wildfire season as of yesterday, August 14th, as well as some information about why and when evacuation orders are made.
I'm Caitlin Bailey, currently in the role of information officer at the Northwest Fire Center. There's currently 20 fires within the Northwest Fire Center. As of today, August 14th, since April 1st, there have been 76 fires within the Northwest Fire Center, which is fairly just under the 10-year average, which is 87 for the same time period. Compared to last year, 2023, at this point in time, there had been 237 fires, so quite a significant difference this year. And last Friday, August 9th, there were more than 400 strikes of lightning across the Northwest Fire Center, and this led to 19 new fires since Friday. As of now, however, 10 of those have been called out, 3 are under control, and 2 are being held, and only 4 of those are still considered out of control.
Okay. We were talking about evacuation alerts. What are the factors that decide on when it is time to evacuate?
Yeah, so BC Wildfire Service, we don't actually implement an evacuation order. However, we make recommendations to either the First Nation or the regional district or the municipality, whoever has jurisdiction in an area. Mm-hmm. So to make that recommendation, some of the different things that we have to consider or that are considered are things like the current fire behavior, as well as forecasted fire behavior, the topography of the area, the impact to people in the area, as well as other values, egress routes, so access of how people would be able to evacuate if required, the types of forests that are available to burn, as well as natural features that might act as a fire guard or act as a area to contain the fire, and short-term weather, so things like wind direction or speed of wind, mm-hmm. that could again significantly impact fire behavior and direction of fire growth. And so once those sorts of things are considered, then there's a conversation with the local jurisdiction or the local government, and BC Wildfire explains to them sort of some of those things, and then they're the ones who actually decide on the area as well as implement the evacuation alert or order and then notify people who are within it.
Yeah. The Voyant Alert system that people are told to use for basically news within your community. Now, I know it's not, the fire center doesn't send out Voyant Alerts. Does the fire center give the RDBN the heads up that it is time to send out an alert like that, or are you not involved with that at all?
We're not involved with the Voyant specifically. So that would be like the recommendation. That's when we have a discussion with them about whether or not we recommend an evacuation alert or order with respect to a specific fire.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at skeenastrong.com. Or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks again to our producer, Pam Hassan, and all of our roving reporters. I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.